The standing mic is right over there, so if you have a question, just head on up and ask it. Yes.
Oh, that's good.
Yes, yeah, that standing mic is for the questions. So sounds like you've got one ready to go.
Okay.
Is this on? Okay, yeah, my question is this. Does the progressive revelation or development of certain doctrines implicitly say something about its value? For example, if God didn't care to articulate the Trinity clearly in the Old Testament, can we reduce its importance in relation to other doctrines?
No, I would say that's not quite the right way to think of it, because all the doctrines are developing. So the Trinity is only one that's developing. And this whole, it's just like, there's two things going on here in my mind. One is that the Old Testament is, to a large extent, like a primer of a child in elementary school and a picture book. And it represents things very physically and carnally. So that by the time you get to Christ and you come to the reality, you understand the reality. I think without this primer and this background, we don't fully understand who Christ is. So all of these doctrines are leading us up to Christ, the final reality. So the seed is in Christ and in his church. The land, as I understand it, is resolved in Christ as the source of life, though I think there is, I don't have in mind a Jewish kingdom. I don't think that the New Testament will sustain it for me. But I do think there's more substantive reality that's beyond comprehension. As to my mind, it's there's a new book. There's a new book out by Joseph Ratzlinger, the ex-Benedict. Not egg, but the ex-Benedict. Anyway. it's a very good book on Jesus of Nazareth. And he uses the analogy of the resurrection body of Jesus is sort of like the final stage of evolution with the intervention of God. It's what we were meant to become ultimately. And so there is, in the resurrection body, there's an already and a not yet. There's something totally different here. And that's how I see the eschaton. There's beyond our comprehension. But the resurrection body of Jesus gives me some inkling of what it's about. So that it enables me to see, to understand this doctrine. So that every one of us is a product of memory. You don't know who you are without a memory. If you had an amnesia, you wouldn't know who you are. You'd say, who am I? This is the value of the Old Testament in my mind, is it gives us a memory. So we understand our identity. And with that memory, I can now understand Jesus and the church in a way I could not understand it before. And I'm hesitant to call it is progressive, but I'm hesitant to use that term because normally progressive theology means the older forms were wrong and we're arriving at the true reality. Well, we're coming to the real substance of which this was a shadow, but that is ultimately truth itself that we have back here. Did that answer your question? Okay, all right. And by the way, on the land, that's the most controversial topic. I think you'll enjoy chapter 20 in the theology. I have three chapters. I see the whole theology is based on this idea of blocks of material and the primary idea that's being developed in this trajectory. And the most difficult doctrine is the land doctrine. And I have one on the Old Testament doctrine of land, the intertestamental doctrine on land, what was happening to the land and the rabbis before the New Testament, and then coming to what does the New Testament teach about land. And so you might find that useful, that chapter. And my understanding of seed and its development and who are the church with reference to Israel, That's in chapter 12, where I'm dealing with the Abrahamic covenant. And who is the seed, and how do we fit into that picture? So I think those two chapters are very crucial to the theology. By the way, I also rewrote Finding the Will of God, a pagan notion, question mark. And I think it is a much better book. And it was more edifying to me. I spent last fall, I read about 15 books since I wrote on the subject. And I think, I really hope God will use it. It was profitable to me writing it. All right. We're now ready for science. The vibrant dance of Genesis 1 and science. So that's how I look at it. That it's a vibrant dance. We're all learning together. The outline of the lecture is, first of all, I'm going to discuss my epistemology, by which I mean my way of knowing reality. Then I'm going to look at exegetical cruxes that are foundational for our study. We have to make some decisions of interpretation, exegetical decisions, and I will address those. And with those out of the way, then I want to make some hermeneutical reflections on our topic and draw some conclusions. So that's where the lecture is going. So my epistemology for knowing reality. First of all, my sources for knowing reality. One of my sources, of course, is my experience. However, I measure matter, science, and bringing cogent reflection to that kind of data that is temporal, that I can measure, physically handle. And so I have both science and reason. And so that is for knowing the natural world that's around me. We do this all intuitively all the time, but I'm trying to think my way through it. For knowing the natural world by experiment, that is gathering data and reasoning about it. An example would be on science and reason. I would ask the question, how do I get to the moon? That is a physical question. There is some way of physics I can get to the moon. My problem is my ignorance. I don't know how to get there. But I can overcome that ignorance through knowledge. I can get there. And we can fly. And we can actually develop a rocket. And we can get to the moon. Incredible that we could do that within two generations. That from the first flight, about 100 years ago, less than 100, 70 years later, we're on the moon. It's just incredible that the human mind can do. But why is the moon there? That I can't get to by reason or science. I cannot answer the question, why does anything exist? Why are we here? Why is there matter? That is something else. And that deals with for knowing the metaphysical reality, something beyond the physical, down to what the ontology of what really is. And for me, that's mystery. And the ultimate questions of life, of where do I come from and why am I here and where am I going, that has to be answered by spirit and by faith, because I cannot get there by the scientific method. I believe ultimately this kind of knowing is a not scientific way of knowing. I think it's consistent. It can be argued for, but I don't think anybody comes to faith by the scientific method. Science may lead you there, but ultimately it doesn't. Not the scientific method cannot ultimately answer the question of why and who. It can answer how and when, but not why and who. And that to me is known spiritually. It's known by the convincing work of the Holy Spirit that's from God. And we cannot make God talk. God speaks to us in our hearts. It has a moral dimension. That to me is as real. What I hear with my spiritual ear is as real as what I hear with my physical ear. And that's where my faith is. And that's what I believe in. That's another dimension. So that is, why is the moon there? And for that, faith has to overcome the mystery of being. And without revelation, I cannot know. And that was one of the major things I concluded in college, that the finite mind cannot come to infinite truth and cannot come to the ontology of what really is. That is another dimension. And that's why I went to Dallas, tell you the truth, because I felt I would get one of the finest biblical educations. At that time, most my age in college were either going to Fuller, where it was more philosophically oriented, or to Dallas, which was more biblically oriented. And that's why I went that direction in life. And what happened to me there, I wanted to be a careful theologian. And then I realized all theology from the Orthodox viewpoint comes down to words. And therefore, to be a good theologian, I had to be a linguist. And that led me on from one degree to another. I did my doctor's work in Greek and New Testament, and they hired me in Hebrew and Old Testament. Then I went to Michigan and got linguistics, so I've been in the pursuit of words because of my love for theology. So, the sources of knowing reality, did I jump a slide here? I should really go to this slide, sources of knowing reality. Let's see, what is historical evidence? Oh, this is the outline of where I'm going, okay. All right, the sources for knowing reality, so far as reason, and I want to deal with historical science. We have to distinguish between historical science and experimental science. That's the first thing when we're dealing with science. There are two kinds of science. There are the hard sciences, and there's the historical science. I think it's also evident from science. There are evidences, we should be looking at the evidences of origins from from historical science. I believe that leads us by reason and data to an intelligent creator, that you have to blind yourself to it, that you don't see it. I think the historical science must lead you logically toward a creator. But fourthly, we have to understand all of our knowledge based on the temporal is never final. It's always shifting because our knowledge is always incomplete. We can never know comprehensively. And unless you know comprehensively, you cannot know absolutely or with certainty. And we can pursue that if you want to. That's a very important concept. Unless you know comprehensively, you can never know with certainty. You have to see the whole. Well, therefore, let's start there. Let's start with the two kinds of sciences, the historical versus the experimental. By the experimental, I mean a science that tests theories under controlled laboratory conditions, so that you should get the same results in every laboratory. And this would deal with the hard sciences such as physics. It's not something that's historical, this is something you have. This would involve chemistry, for example. You can test theories under controlled laboratory conditions. And what you're aiming to do then is to establish universal laws by inductive reasoning of how the chemistry works, or how the physics works. And that's what you do. in these disciplines. Our subject is not subject to experimental science because we cannot put in a laboratory the creation. That's a historical science. This would include geology, the fossil record, paleontology, study of ancient bones and so forth. This includes evolutionary biology. This cannot test the theory under controlled laboratory conditions. It tests the theory by their explanatory power. What theory best explains my data? And to do this, you have to determine ancient conditions to explain present manifest effects. And so you have to reconstruct. In other words, this is a different kind of reasoning. It is not deductive reasoning where you get a proposition and out of that you can draw logical entailments deductively. It's not inductive reason, as in the laboratory science, that you get a lot of data and you induce a theory. This is abductive reasoning. You go back, I got this, how did this get here, how did that get there, you get back, back, back. That's abductive reasoning. And that's the kind of reasoning that you have to use in this kind of a discipline on origins. Obviously, it's by abductive reasoning. Abductive reasoning is absolutely essential for humans. Without abductive reasoning, we couldn't have history. We can explain something that we see by fact of if we sing the national anthem, we go back what caused the rocket's red glare, we go back and what caused that, and you can, in other words, that's how history is done. The only way you can explain some phenomena in Europe is by Napoleon. This is how detective work is done. And what you have to do with detective work is you have to establish a situation that's beyond reasonable doubt. You can never establish it certainly. But to argue that you cannot have origins because you can't reconstruct it under laboratory condition, to my mind, in that logic, forget about history and forget about the judicial system. Because you can never prove anybody guilty, because you can never reconstruct the crime. So this is how abductive reasoning works. You have to, it's logical. It's abstract, it's abductive reasoning. You're reasoning back, this best explains my data at the present moment. And that's what we're talking about. And so I distinguish clearly between mystery and faith and the metaphysics and the physics. And I'm distinguishing clearly in the physics between experimental science versus historical science. And the two different kinds of logic going on. So that's where I'm coming from in my epistemology. So we're ultimately looking for the unique cause, what best explains the data. And we do make mistakes. Criminals have been put to death because of insufficient data. I mean, innocent people have been put to death because of insufficient data. It can never be absolutely certain. And that's why, as I say, I do not build my life on this. It's too uncertain. I can only say, abductively, this makes the most sense to me. That's as far as I go. That it's beyond reasonable doubt, I think we may draw different conclusions on that. But I think at least this puts it in a frame of reference in which we can think intelligently about our topic. The evidences of origins from the historical mainstream science, so far as I can tell, is that the Big Bang is almost beyond reasonable doubt, as far as I can tell. Now, I'm not an astrophysicist, but try to read in the field. And so far as I can tell, from the redshift of stars, the background radiation, et cetera, it seems to me that mainstream science is most plausible when it says the earth has been here, the universe began 13.7 million years ago, and has drawn the conclusion against an eternal steady state. In other words, before the Hubble telescope, it was thought there was an origin and an explosion and everything collapsed again and everything exploded. That's been gone indefinitely. But part of the problem is, you see, I don't think the human mind can understand infinity. It's outside of our total experience. Everything for us has a beginning and an end. Logically, we know something is. The materialist believes matter is, always was, always will be. And so that's God, matter. I cannot buy that, because matter is logical. It has a logic about it. And so I don't understand why Einstein didn't become a believer, because he said, what's incomprehensible is that science is comprehensible. How is it the human mind can understand it? The human mind is logical. Therefore, there must have been a logic behind it. That's mind. So, from my viewpoint, mind came before matter. And once you go there, you're going with, to me, what the Bible claims, my head is telling me what my heart knows, God is. There's no dichotomy for me here. God is. And so every child wants to know, where did God come from? There is no, that's the wrong question. God is. Something is. And we can't comprehend it. Neither can we comprehend infinite space. We cannot comprehend Einstein's theory of relativity, because even at that, space is something somewhere, in my mind. You see, we can't get there. So, at any rate, mainstream science is now confirming, and it's, I think it's almost universally accepted, that the universe began 13.7 billion years ago. And I buy that. Wouldn't die for it, but it's plausible. So that's where I'm now understanding myself. And I think the cosmic anthropological principle is really cogent. That is, the physical qualities at the beginning were such as a strong nuclear force constant, a gravitational force constant, the expansion rate of the universe, the average distance between stars, and the values of other physical quantities had to be so precise to affect, and here if you assume evolution, to affect and bring into pass, bring into being thinking creatures who could reflect upon their origins, which we are doing. If you buy into Big Bang and you buy into evolution, everything had to be so precise in the very beginning that through natural processes, if you wish, though I'm not convinced of that, but through natural processes, eventually we came to be. And we could reflect upon our origins. That is known as the cosmic anthropological principle. So we conflict upon their origins that the laws of probability rule out chance. In other words, the scientific community, to a large extent, believes everything is chance. Chance is God, and you're accountable to none. I can't draw that conclusion. It's too precise. I cannot believe everything just happened, and here we are. To me, that's illogical. And from a scientific viewpoint, abductive reasoning, I just can't accept it. It's illogical to me. It's just too precise. Well, the way you get around that, of course, is to go with Stephen Hawking and assume there's billions and billions of universes, so that out of billions, one got it right. And we happen to be the one that got it right. To me, that is desperate. There's absolutely no evidence for that, except laws of probability. I think that's willful ignorance. There must have been intent and design from the beginning. So however we got to be here, as I look at it, by abductive reasoning, there had to be an intelligent designer, minimally. And for an intelligent designer to design this and create someone who can reflect and then say it's all a big joke is diabolical. Whoever he is evil. I can't go there. Now, I'm just thinking in terms of natural reasoning, of where I am, and I'm trying to, and we can debate it, but this is my thoughts on it. The evidences of origins from the historical, except the Big Bang. I expect the cosmic anthropological principle. And I think biologists agree that life could not have begun on this planet as it was in the beginning, as best they know it. It's inexplicable. Life's origins are inexplicable from the givens of this Earth. And I think our space program, our worship of science, is similar to the pyramids of the ancient world and Stonehenge. All of them are trying to find out what's reality in a physical sort of a way. And I see science doing that. They're trying to find from their god of naturalism and matter, life originating. And if they could show it originated spontaneously elsewhere, then the laws of probability would be such that it arose spontaneously here, and it's all an accident with no meaning. And so we try to find origins of life elsewhere. Maybe we will. But see, it's all diabolical. You read the headlines of the Seattle Times with this the astronomer who, and they say he believes in science and God, as though you can't believe in both. And that's what's wrong. Because all they have is matter and science. They do not understand what I'm talking about. There's another dimension to life. I believe in the God of science. I don't pit them against one another. So, I think also, from mainstream science, life forms evolved over much time. Not in 24-hour consecutive days. That's according to the fossil record. And all the scientific evidence does not allow, as far as I know, a 24-hour consecutive explanation of creation. I'm left with, we're here either by chance or by providence. And today, no longer speaks of providence, because there's no God. We speak of Lady Luck. We speak of chance. We speak of Mother Nature. Anything but God. Also, as I understand from the fossil record, from Stephen Gould, there is punctuated equilibrium. And I don't see anybody refuting that, which would be sudden bursts of new life forms in the fossil record. So I'm left with, it's all here by chance, or God used natural selection, just natural processes, and he guided it and superintended it, or there was divine intervention. And one of the differences between Biologos and Discovery Institute is on all Christians rule out the first one. Today, the debate to me is between Biologos and the Discovery Institute. Biologos believes that. There's a difference between I believe that and I believe in. Okay? There's a big difference for me. So if I say I believe that is not the same as I believe in. There are Christians who believe that Jesus is the Son of God, but they don't believe in Jesus as the Son of God, and that's life and death. So whenever I talk about science, I'm talking about, if I say I believe, I mean I believe that. But I'm not committed to it. It's not my faith structure. Now, that's a very important distinction. Of course, you can't make these distinctions in a three-minute YouTube, which I've learned not to communicate that way. I had no idea. I mean, I've never communicated this way. I'll never do it again. All right. So, or it's providence by natural selection, or it is divine intervention. You have two schemas here. You can think of life as evolving from simple to complex as a single tree. Or you can think of it as an orchard with numbers of interventions. Now, I think Biologos is hesitant about intervention for the first one because you can't demonstrate, how should I put this? Yeah, you can't prove divine intervention, and I think they're afraid of that. I think they're afraid of, well, whatever we can't explain, that's God. And they're afraid of going that route. Discovery Institute says, look, if there was divine intervention to begin with, why couldn't there be divine interventions along the way? And that's logical to me, too. And so if God intervened to bring first life, which the evidence is pointing to, then why didn't God intervene to begin subsequent forms of life? It's not necessarily, therefore, a natural process of evolution. But for me, I don't have to decide that. I don't really care. As I put it, and I'll put it later, I don't care whether you're an oozer or a zapper. You get the difference. Oozer is evolution. Zapper is intervention. What I'm concerned about is there was somebody doing it. There was God. That's what I'm interested in. That's where the evidence leads me in abductive reasoning. Fourth, there's a beauty and comprehensibleness about what I look at. There is an intelligent creator, like Aristotle. Should a man live underground and converse with the works of art and mechanism, and afterwards be brought up into the day to see the several glories of the heaven and earth, he would immediately pronounce them the work of such a being as we define God to be. It's a wonderful quote. It's awesome. In art, science. And this is what Paul is saying. To me, this is the real issue of the debate. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. And we can get all balled up in a lot of detail and miss the big picture. And I think as ministers, we should insist on this because I don't see how you can escape it. Okay, so far I talked about historical science, evidences from historical science, intelligent creator. Now I'm up to the next point, the relativity of uncertain knowledge. That our knowledge depends upon fluctuating experimental science. And I already made the point, without comprehensive knowledge, we cannot arrive at absolute knowledge. We used to think forest fires were always bad, now we know they're necessary and they're good. What we call bad is now sometimes good. We used to think damming up water was good, now we know it may be bad. So what we thought was good is now bad because our knowledge wasn't complete. My favorite illustration of this is when I taught at Westminster. The finest, most beautiful building at Westminster is their library. And you can tell a lot about a school by its architecture. If you go to Westminster, the social area is a little shack. The big thing is the library. If you go to Regent, the big thing is the coffee shop. The library's in the basement. But you can see the school changing, because now it's got quite a significant library, and you can see the changes. You can tell a lot. If you want to know what school to go to, visit the campus. The architecture will tell you a lot about it, but be that as it may. The library is a beautiful building at Westminster. My office was in the basement. we had student, this was back in the late 80s when jobs were plentiful, and at that point in seminaries we had a lot of students who were in midlife crisis, changing jobs. You could change jobs readily. So we had one student who had worked for NASA, and he measured radon gas. And then he wanted to go into ministry. He came to Westminster. He was trained as a geologist. His wife was an RN. She got a job at a local hospital. Well, his being a geologist, he looked at it and he said, I think there's radon gas here. So he decided, he was concerned for his wife's health. He was concerned that he decided he would measure the radon gas in her hospital. And he came to our library, it was down in the basement in the library. Well, he says, I got the equipment here, might as well set it up and see what's going on at Westminster. So he put it on the shelf. Now, to understand his readings, you need to understand that the atmosphere has normally 4 picocuries. That's a thousandth of a nanny of radon gas, extremely small. If you are a chain smoker, you will inhale 200 picocuries of radon gas. If you work in a uranium mine, you will inhale 400 picocuries, and after a year, you have to take 3 years, you take a year off to detox. Uranium mine is 400. His reading for our library was 4,000. 10 times uranium mine. If true, it would be about the highest concentration of radon gas found in the United States. He couldn't believe it. So he wrote back to the NASA in Huntsville, and they came with the most sophisticated equipment and confirmed his reading. 4,000. I didn't know this was going on. Came in the next day. Black and yellow tape on the windows and the doors. Lethal. Stay out. This is my office. I was working in worse than a uranium mine. I mean, the worst in the world. My point is, what they thought was the best was the worst. Because without comprehensive knowledge, they didn't know that 40 miles down, there was a fault right under the library, and probably rocks that were vertical and not horizontal that were breaking apart like the leaves of a book and emitting this tremendous volume of radon gas. But because they didn't have comprehensive knowledge, they chose the worst place they could when they thought they had chosen the best place. That illustrates what I'm trying to drive at. Unless you know comprehensively, you can never know certainly. And that's why I need revelation. Otherwise, I'm just a blind man going around here. So, an abductive reasoning, furthermore, cannot prove a universal negative. You can never prove the negative. If you've ever been in debate, you know that's an old debatist technique. You try to put the person in a position to prove a negative, and you can't prove a negative. It's logically impossible. So I tentatively believe that, which mainstream science teaches about origins. I do not believe in mainstream science, but I work within the framework of mainstream science. That seems to me, to be the most intelligent, plausible position for me to adopt and work within it. And I'm not trying to convert anybody. I'm just saying this, to me, is plausible. Now, Scripture is my source for knowing the origins of cosmos theologically. And they say it's inerrant as to its source It's certain knowledge because the source has comprehensive knowledge and the source does not deceive. It's infallible for authority and practice. My interpretation of Scripture is not inerrant, but subject to correction by better exegesis. And we're all in the process of learning and growing. And we try to keep people from thinking. And we box them in. I don't think that's healthy for the church. I think we have to have systematic, basic restraints that are certain. First thing I wrote after I went to region, I left Dallas, was dogmatic theology and relative knowledge. Where I tried to think my way through this. There, by the way, there's a book coming out with Edmonds. It's just been advertised, The Dance Between God and Humanity. And I frankly think this is going to be a big money loser for Edmonds. But anyway, they've collected a whole bunch of my essays, and they're putting them together into, well, that's their decision. Anyway, one of the essays is on dogmatic theology and relative knowledge, in which I tried to think my way through this to some extent, where I was back in 1976 when I left. Okay, so much for that. What do I do when reason and when revelation and reason conflict about temporal origins? Well, one thing is, and many students do this, you jettison the Bible. And that will lead to nihilism. It's death. Others, you jettison science. And to me, that leads to insanity. You're not living in a real world. For me, I will reconsider my exegesis. And that's what the rest of this lecture is about. Some resolutions. But recognizing the finite mind cannot achieve infinite truth, I believe that my resolutions are true or helpful. But you should understand, I do not believe in them. I'm a person of faith, fundamentally, trying to grow and to learn. So exegetical cruxes in Genesis 1. I guess I didn't list them all. One of the cruxes is the syntax of, and the earth was waste and void, Genesis 1:1. This deals with Genesis 1:1-3. This deals with the age of the earth, according to the Bible itself. The conjunctive vav there, you see the wah, you see I transliterated it to wah-ha-aretz. The conjunction vav and can be understood, well, the vav can be understood in three different ways. God created the heavens and the earth, and this is the way it was when he created it. And the earth was tohu vabohu. So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was this way, and then God said. Now that's traditional, and it's grammatically possible. What's the error to me for this, though, in part is that that becomes part of the first day. And we see what you have in Hebrew, we call a narrative vav. You get a background situation, and then comes the main story. It's in Genesis 2. This is the background that was not yet this, was not yet that. And then God formed the man. Genesis 1, 1 and 2. There was not this, was tohu vabohu, it was darkness. And then God said. If you accept the just accept the conjunctive vav, the earth is already here when you start. It's not part of the first day. Unless you make it part of the first day. And that's difficult. Well, the other one is, and this is in all the modern translations, official modern translations, New American Bible, New English Bible, this is by major denominations at any rate, it's a potasis vav. That is then. So you translate it this way. When God began to create the heavens and the earth, then the earth was. That's to say very clearly that the earth was already waste, darkness, and water when you begin. I gave a lecture on this at Weston Seminary back in 1976 and worked on it pretty diligently. The series of articles are in Bibliotheca Sacra, 1976, came to the conclusion that it is a disjunctive vav. Now, that is to say, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth had been, I'm not claiming the gap theory here, that would be the most normal way to read this. Now, the earth had been, before God intervened in it, darkness, chaos, uninhabited, uninhabitable. All three interpretations, it seems to me, assume the earth is already here when you begin. And then God said, let there be light. In other words, there is no word from God that says, let there be earth in darkness. There is no word from God that says, let there be chaotic waters. There is no word from God that says, let there be earth. It's just not there. We know that all things were created by the word of God, but there's no word of God in Genesis 1-2. It seems to be and is, and it's a mystery to me. I don't believe it's eternal, because I know only God is eternal. But it is. It's there when you begin. Therefore, from just an exegetical viewpoint, I have no problems with the 13.7 billion years. Young earth, old earth is not the issue to me. I don't care. Exegetically, it can go any way it wants. I'm often sometimes invited by old earth people to lecture for the old earth, or by young earth people to represent an old earth viewpoint. I can't do that. I don't know the age of the earth as an exegete. But you could see, if mainstream science says it's 13.7 billion years old, that's no problem for me as an exegete. There's no contradiction between them. The issue is the fossil record, not the age of the earth. And I think astronomically, the beginning of the earth, the universe 13.7 billion years ago, is extremely firm data and has nothing to do with Genesis 1. And I think, again, it's a misinterpretation. Another valid point for me is that all debate is valuable. It's a heuristic value. Heuristic means it puts us in the happy position to learn something. Doubts are good. They're ants in your pants. You might learn something in the process. Second question. And God saw, and so forth. God said, God saw. And when it says God rested, in Exodus 31, the word nafash means God refreshed himself. God caught his breath. You see, that's anthropomorphic language. It's representing God as a human worker. And he caught his breath. And stopped. I'll say more, I'll mention it later. Why does God not work at night? It was evening, it was morning, then we work again. What's going on there? Can't God create at night? This ought to raise some questions for us. What's going on in Genesis 1? And really what I'm trying to do is provoke your thinking. There's something else going on here than perhaps the way I traditionally thought. Even the most conservative commentator, my predecessor at Westminster, Young, says, it is certainly true that God did not speak with physical organs of speech. Does God have eyes? Does God have ears? Does God have vocal cords? What language does God speak? And when Schultens came out in 1732, and he said, God must have spoken Arabic, because the evidence is Arabic is the oldest language, he was almost railroaded out of the school. Because they thought, well, God must speak Hebrew. I don't think he spoke Hebrew. What does it mean, God said? What? Did he speak 6th century Hebrew? It's anthropomorphic. What is the meaning of day is another crucial issue. I believe it refers to a 24-hour day. There's three different ways that yom is used in this account. One is it can refer to the daylight from dawn to dusk. And he called the light day. That's one way of using it. It can refer to the whole 24-hour period. And it was evening and the morning, day one. It can be used as an indefinite period of time, but that is controlled. That is philological, what we call in linguistics, philologically conditioned. When it says, like, for example, the argument is made from the, and I like you, Ross, don't misunderstand me, but they hold to this day-age theory. And they say, well, day doesn't necessarily mean 24 hours. Well, it doesn't mean that, but you can tell when it doesn't mean that. It has a preposition bet or it's in construct with another noun. That's philologically controlled. That's just very, very careless linguistics to argue it. I say it can mean that in construct with another noun. For example, in the day God created the heavens and the earth is a quasi-prepositional phrase meaning when. In my judgment, I cannot buy it. The day-age theory is not supported by Hebrew philology. Nor do I think the fossil record fits very well for the day-age theory either. So that's where I have trouble with the Discovery Institute. The Discovery Institute wants an extended periods of time and match it up with the fossil record. But the fossil record has marine life before plant life by millions of years. The meanings of bara, it means to create, and asa means to make. I don't agree with John Walton and the function theory, the last word of Genesis 1. He wants to make the word create not to bring matter into existence, but to matter already in existence to enable it to function. And he believes Genesis 1 is about God making a temple. All this material is already here, but now it's all brought together to make it function as a temple. I cannot draw that conclusion from these verbs. It's a nice solution. I'm sure John, it helps him putting science and the Bible together. I think that's what's going on. And he does make a good point. Why is it that God calls the light day? He argues it was the function of light. Was to create a day. That's the main argument in favor of it. But for me, it's not going to work. Bara means to bring into existence and to function in a determined way. And John did help me to see more how it does function. But notice, then God said, let there be light. And there was light. That is, he brought it into existence. God saw the light that it was good. And he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and that's how it functions. It functions to give us time. But I don't want to pit them against one another, but he did help me to see a functional aspect to the creation. In the ancient Near Eastern cosmogonies, that is, cosmology is the study of the cosmos. Cosmogony is the origins of the cosmos. So in the ancient Near Eastern cosmogonies, it involves both notions. So create refers to the origins of cosmic matter and not merely function, contrary to Walton's viewpoint. I was just at a conference with the Templeton Foundation about 2 months ago, and John was there. And after we really debated it, even those who had agreed with him came to disagree with him. I don't think anybody was agreeing with him by the end of that discussion, to my knowledge. So I talked about the, and God said as an anthropomorphic. I talked about yom as being, as far as I can tell, a 24-hour day, evening. What does it mean, evening and morning, day one, if it isn't referred to a day? Talked about the meaning of bara, and we should be aware that the light existed before the firmament. The second day he created the firmament. I think we usually think he created light, and we think of the light on a firmament. There is no firmament. This creates problems. Try to picture that. You have light. before there's a firmament. That's what it says. And you have light before there are luminaries. It just existed. How science is that? I don't know. What am I to make of the refrain, and it became evening and became morning, day X? This refrain, it became evening and it morning, always refers to sunset and sunrise. So I got sunset, sunrise, and the fourth day he made the sun to make time. It seems to me the text is not allowing me to read it in a very straightforward way. And we're not allowing it to give us its own clues. The intention of it is to say creation did not happen in a day. And the significance is that God is represented as a worker and a model to us, that he worked for his reward. Just as an aside, what the world is about is to get as much money as you can with as little work as possible. And the creation won't allow that. God worked, and he got his reward. And that's the model, that's the reality that we should be living by. This is why I'm against lotteries, I'm against gambling, I'm against lots of stuff. I'm not against a glass of wine, by the way. All right. And God said, let land and sea produce living creatures. I don't know how they did it. That's just a statement. God said, let it happen. And to try to rule out some kind of scientific explanation to me is folly. Why try it? Genesis blanks the means and or manner of the origins of biological species. A scientific account of it. It just does not give it to us. And it's mischievous to pit that statement, God said, let there be, against science. It's as mischievous, I say, as if we took Genesis 139:13, David says, you created my inmost being. You may be interested. You know what the Hebrew says? You created my kidneys. But that doesn't sound any good. You created my kidneys. So you know what you do? You do with the King James. You created my reins. What are reins? The French rein, the French word for kidneys. But that sounds good. You created my reins. just an aside. Okay. You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth, as it were. In other words, it would be mischievous to put that statement that God, you made me, and that's a tremendous statement of faith. I think it takes more faith than to say, I believe in God, the creator of heaven and earth. It takes more faith for me to say, I believe God created me. That's incredible. My point is, though, it is mischievous to pit a natural explanation for origins against the theological explanation for origins. I believe in the Creator, but I'm open to the scientific explanations for origins. They should not be pitted against one another. For me, that is highly mischievous. The Bible is concerned with ultimate cause, not immediate natural causes. It does not decide, as I say, between oozes and zappers. The point is, God did it. However, he did it. And then we've come up with the sequence of days. This leads me to look at the framework hypothesis. There's no question but that there is artistic design, and Northrop Frye in his classic, The Great Code, says, wherever you have artistry in literature, he calls it myth. I don't want to call it misleading. You have something creative going on. Anyway, this is well known. Light, first day, luminaries the fourth day, firmament the second day, fish, the birds the fifth day, sea, fish. And then you get land and the plants and the trees, and you get the land creatures and the humankind that live on it for the sixth day. There are two triads of days. The hypothesis of Meredith Klein is that it divides the days into two triads, and this symmetry represents the creation solely from an artistic perspective, without attempting to give a temporal sequence of days or of designating a 24-hour period of time. Now, in my circles, you can buy that because you're still holding to 6 days. It doesn't matter if they're sequential, it doesn't matter how long they are. You still say it's 6 days, so you're accepted. To me, this runs roughshod over the normal significance of the narrative verb form, which is sequential. And this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. It runs roughshod, to me, over the normal meaning of day. It can be any extended period of time. And I do not understand if it is not to be ordered sequentially. Why bother with 1 to 7? So I don't buy into the framework hypothesis. I don't buy into Walton's theory. I'm not buying into a lot of these theories. And why I'm don't. This is the joy of being a Protestant. I'm laying my cards out on the table. Then you can all, and it has to be so we can all understand it. I now come to the meaning of the firmament, rakia. And I think you have to understand it within its own historical contextualization. Rakia means to beat out. And Jerome understood it to be something firm. What's firm? What's the firmament? It's the blue dome over your head, as I understand it. Now, Laird Harris, my good friend, I think he's probably dead now. He thinks it's just expanse, but I can't go there. I think it is the firmament. The stars are in it. There's a 9th century BC. I think the firmament is the dome, and the water above is the blue in Genesis 1. That would be the normal way of understanding it. A 9th century BC Assyrian relief shows the sun god Shamash, the word Shemesh, as you know in Hebrew, is sun, seated on his throne. Beneath the canopy over the throne are symbols of the three celestial deities, moon, sun, Venus. Under the throne are a number of wavy lines representing the celestial ocean. The inscription reads that the stellar deities are situated above the ocean. Beneath the heavenly ocean is a slab that divides the waters above from those beneath. Here you have it. Here you see Shamash. And in the relief, there are two bulls holding up his throne, mythical thinking. Here you see the celestial deities, the moon, the sun, and Venus. And here's the sun being dragged, drawn along. Notice it's over. The sun is resting on the water, and then you got a slab. That's how they pictured it. And I think that's how the Bible pictures the three-dimensional universe, that you have a three dimensions. So, I couldn't find the relief. I remember one time I was in one of the pyramids, one of the three great pyramids, and there in one of the main burial sites where the sarcophagus it was, there was a beautiful painting of the sky, and the Egyptian god Nut, N-U-T, goddess Nut, is the sky. And she is represented as a woman. And she is, her hands, her fingertips are in the east, her toe tips are in the west. And she's arched above. They had a goddess called Shu. She was the atmosphere, and Shu is holding her up like this. In her body, there are stars. On top of that, there is blue for the ocean, painted. And on top of that, there is a little boat with the sun in it. And you can see this is how they saw it. They saw it as a blue ocean up there. He separated the waters from the waters. It can't refer to the clouds. He put the stars in the rakia. Did he put the stars in the clouds? Obviously not. But let's be clear what the text is saying. And I think you can see it's very phenomenological. This is not scientific language, is what I'm trying to say. And I think we make a big mistake when we try to make it science. It's not. Now, some theological reflections on all this. The hermeneutics, reflections. I've gone through seven crucial exegetical points. I can't argue them in detail here, but at least where I'm coming from, and you can investigate them. Now, reflections. Here I'm going to reflect on the nature of narrative literature. Secondly, on the historical contextualization of the Bible. And naturally, it flows out of that, is the cosmogony in the biblical world. And, as I've been saying, an anthropomorphic representation of the Creator as a worker. Literature consists of two parts. Well, narrative literature, and this is narrative. There is a historical reality, ostensive reality. It consists of story, what happened, and plot. That is, you take the event and you put them into a larger story that's called the plot, that gives meaning to the story, to the event. So it's part of a larger story, and that's called the plot. So you have, this is the narrator's creative representation of the historical reality. There is a meta-narrative, and it's something metaphysical that he's making all this fit into. So I illustrate that by this, so you can see what I'm driving at. Okay, so you know that this is... All right, now, is that glass half full or full? I think most of you will say, well, that's stupid, it's half full of water. And I'm saying, no. It's more accurate to say it's full. It's full of gas. The difference is the upper half is invisible gas. The lower half is visible gas. Okay? So it's full. It's full of gas. Just two different kinds of gas compounds going together. One visible, one invisible. All right. Now, I want you to paint that reality. I want you to paint the invisible. I think you will see you cannot paint the invisible. It's impossible. You're going to do something creative. Maybe you'll put dots in it, but you added. You were creative. Maybe you put waving lines, but you've added to it. Now, what I would do is I put the water on the top. I put the air on the bottom. It would defy gravity, but I don't think it'd say it's half full. You'd get the point it's full, and maybe it'd get you to think about it a bit. But now I want to do something else. I not only want you to paint the invisible, I want you to teach something from it. You want to teach the abstract idea that both the invisible gases and the water are essential to life. Now, how can you teach an abstract idea? It's not there. You have to represent it somehow. What I would do is I'd put a goldfish in the top and I'd put a canary in the bottom. It'd be a very strange, it'd be Picasso all the way. All right? But it gets you thinking about it. And you'd say, hey, what's going on? And maybe you'd get the idea of what I was trying to communicate. That's how I see Genesis 1. I can't get light and all that's going on. It seems to me it's kind of topsy-turvy. It's presented a certain way, but it's telling me it's creative. This is not myth. And all too often, you're either historical or you're myth. That's not myth. It's based on reality. There's a real half glass of water and invisible gas. That's reality, but I'm creatively representing it. So it's historical fact. But the Bible has given me more than historical fact. It's creatively representing it. If only we would let it be creative and let it give us the clues to its creativity instead of coming with a preconceived idea, this is scientific literature. And the people often who are trying to defend the Bible are scientists, and they try to read it as scientific literature. And I'm saying it's not. It's creative literature. This is literature that has two aspects to it. The evidence of the creativity, so the narrator creatively fits the story into the plot. And the evidence of creativity in Genesis 1 to me are the anthropomorphisms. God saw, God said, the symmetry of days, and the incompatible, and then I can't put the two creation accounts together between the first creation account and the second creation account. That's, to me, they're just incompatible. And the argument is, well, you're making the Bible contradict itself. And I'm saying, no, I'm not making the Bible contradict itself. I'm letting the Bible tell its story the way it wants to tell its story. I stand under the text. I don't come with preconceived notions of how it should tell the story. I let it tell the story for what it really is. And maybe I'll get what it's driving at. So here we get the first account. You have the trees. And then you get the animals and the man and the woman on the sixth day. I made a mistake. You got the new one, I changed it around. But anyway, it's on the sixth day, you get the animals as well. So first came the trees, then came the animals, then came the man and woman. What do you get in Genesis 2? First comes the man, then come the trees, then comes the animal and the birds, then came the woman. All on the sixth day. Second count. Now, these are all vayetov false, sequential. This happened, then this happened, and this happened, this happened. He formed the man from the clay, planted a garden, caused the trees to grow. The word tzamach means from when you plant them to big trees. I accept apparent age as a possibility. I believe when Jesus changed water into wine, it had to take apparent age for that to happen. So I'm not against apparent age, but this word won't let me to do that. The word means cause them to grow. For them to grow in 3 days is miracle growth, believe me. I'd like to have that for my garden. Then he puts the man in the garden. Then he commands the man's diet. Then God reflects on the man's loneliness. So God forms the animals and the birds. The man names the animals and the birds. God puts man in a coma. Then he takes a rib out of the man. He builds a woman. And the man composes a poem. All in daylight. 12 hours. To me, that's not compatible. Now, what you do in the translations, what the NIV does, is at this point, planted a garden, they make it a pluperfect. Now, God had planted the garden. So that's on the third day. You still got a problem. The ESV won't allow that, so how do they get around it? Well, they bring in the pluperfect here, with God had formed the animals. But they're both juggling the text to make it fit. And I'm saying, you're juggling the text. The King James has it right. This. But these that have a concept of inerrancy, they're forcing the Hebrew into pluperfects. And it's not the normal way of Hebrew. It's possible, but it's just not normal to do it. So I can't put the two accounts together. And I think it's telling me you don't read it this way. This creativity. Let the storyteller tell the story the way he wants to tell it. So I'm open to creativity without denying the historical reality. I don't pit them against one another. It's telling me what that historical reality means. So I think it's referring to one-week creation, a 24-hour day, a way I can enter into it, understand it. Secondly, the historical contextualization of the Bible. Every human achievement is historically contextualized, says a very conservative scholar of the old Princeton, Henry Green, Moses and the Prophets. Every production of any age bears the stamp of that age. It takes its shape from the influences then at work. Let me illustrate that. It takes its shape from the influences at work. We had a big debate at Dallas one time in the faculty meeting. They wanted to reduce teaching Hebrew. I teach Hebrew. So one of the faculty members said, what difference would the Old Testament make in our doctrinal statement? So that was the challenge. What difference would it make? I said, I really don't know. I'll look at the doctrinal statement. Well, I found out in Dallas's doctrinal statement, the references to Old Testament, out of the many references, there were 14. And these included Genesis 3, Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, Daniel 9, most esoteric texts. So I came back and said, wouldn't make any difference. But I noticed something. There were 39 printed lines about angels. There were 6 lines about God. What does that say? Are angels 6 times more important than God? The issue was that Chafer was battling the modernism that was denying angels. It took its shape from its age. In fact, back when Chafer drew it up, inerrancy wasn't the debate. There's nothing in the Dallas statement that says inerrant Bible. Everything takes its shape by the age in which it is given. It is part of the life of the period and can only be properly estimated and understood from being viewed in its original connection. This gets you into the big problem of the sociology of knowledge. You cannot think outside of your experience. And that's why I don't think we could talk about the new heaven and the new earth. I don't think you could talk to a baby in the womb about light and the air and all. It's all known as water and darkness. You got to be creative. So, best I understand, the cosmology of Genesis fits the cosmology of the ancient Near East, a three-tiered universe. Let me exhibit that. Take, for example, the word heart. In the Old Testament, the heart is the source of life. Everything you do comes from your heart in the Old Testament. It's also your spirit. It's everything, your disposition, your character, your volition. When your heart dies, you don't die. It means you stop moving. Here's an illustration. Nabal's heart died within him. By Yamet Libo, his heart died. Birkivo. And he became like stone. We would say he had a stroke. But they say his heart died. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died by Yamet. In other words, for us, if the heart died, rigor mortis would have set in within several days. So, it refers to all your spiritual activity. And this is just kind of a joke. In the Old Testament, I doubt they would have had a heart transplant. Today, I would not, if it were possible, I would not have a brain transplant. Because I don't know whether I would be getting somebody else's body or somebody else would be getting my body. Not that anybody would want it, but anyway. I think you can see what I'm driving at. It's not scientific language, is what I'm driving at. Time to stop.
Can we take a break for lunch?
There we go. The heart stopped.